Show Me the Science with Professor Luke O'Neill, a new podcast series from Newstalk.
Hello, I'm Luke O'Neill, and welcome to this week's Show Me the Science, where I take a topic that is of interest to me, and I hope to you, and I dig into it from a scientific point of view. Well, this week, it's something that dominates all our lives, the science of social media.
Now that I've gotten on the internet, I'd rather be on my computer than doing just about anything. The internet gave us a whole world of exciting new possibilities.
Internet is that massive computer
right.
network, the one that's becoming really big now.
What do you mean? That's big? How does one... What do you write to it, like mail?
No, a lot of people use it.
Tonight's Late Late Show is going out live on the internet. On the worldwide. On the internet. Tell us from Alaska to Hong Kong.
The Facebook.com. Is this perhaps the next big thing?
When we first launched, we were hoping for, you know, maybe 400, 500 people.
Welcome to Facebook.
But the world is getting worse. And I blame the beginning of its demise on social media.
Dad, I'm trending on Twitter.
That is Instagram.
Facebook and Instagram and Twitter allowed politicians to speak directly to voters. And it served as a microphone for those who've never had one.
It literally changes your relationship with society, with each other.
And now we're at 100,000 people, so who knows where we're going next.
Reports have surfaced showing the social networking site was a breeding ground for misinformation during the
election. I guess this is a story of how it changed our lives. Maybe it will yours too.
Oh, I can hear people going, oh God. What's he going to tell us about this now? And it's a really interesting thing, actually, from a scientific point of view, because I'm old enough to remember when there was no social media. I can remember the time when there was no email, there was no Twitter, there was no Facebook, there was no Google, nothing. I mean, it seems ridiculous now, doesn't it? Because these things are so much a part of our lives. And of course, it's all about technology and how this stuff got invented. I'll give you some of the history of it, which is actually quite interesting, how we went from nothing at all to this world that's now dominated by social media. Is it good? Is it bad? What are the uses? Does it help us as scientists? And in fact, it does. One reason why science has advanced so quickly in the past 3, 4, 5 years is very simple, and it's down to things like Google, things like Twitter, massive information exchange, because science is all about information, remember, and the rate at which information is exchanged now is massive. When I was a student, you had to go to a place called a library. Has anybody heard of libraries? There are these buildings with things called books. Have you ever heard of books? And you went to a bookshelf, got the book down, made notes and left. And this was quite a laborious thing. Now, Google, bang, there's the information. Fantastic. So that's one aspect of this information exchange. But obviously, it also dominates our social lives, our personal lives are fully now dominated by various aspects of social media.
Facebook is pervasive. The world's population is over 7 billion. Close to 3 billion of us are active Facebook users.
And again, lots of questions about how do we control it? How do we make it better? And we're going to go into some of these things in this week's podcast. Now, how do we define it? Get ready. Us scientists love to define things. And of course, a huge number of new words and concepts surround social media. You'd have heard of HTML, JPEG, all these things. It is an interactive, digitally mediated technology that facilitates the creation or sharing and exchange of information and interests. There's the definition of what social media is, because obviously it's digital, it's technology, and it's about exchange and sharing of information and interests. And that's where the more social part comes into us, I guess. The other thing that makes it interesting is it's user-generated content. So unlike other things in the past, where it was generated by, say, experts, say, journalists or whatever it is, everybody now is on social media generating the content. And that allows for the development of what are called social networks. So there's a phrase that we all now know about, the social network. And we get loads of very complex social networks forming on social media. And if you're kind of a sociologist or even an anthropologist, studying humans on social media reveals things about us, our needs, our desires, what makes us happy, what doesn't. So it's a very interesting thing in terms of psychology as well, I suppose. And then remember, it is all about documenting memories. That's an aspect. And it's all about learning and exploring. And they're the positive things, because it's a great place to put your memories and your photographs and your videos and everything. And it's a great place to learn and explore. And without social media, Zoom is part of this, for example. Any technology that enhances communication, what would we be doing during COVID? We'd all be in bits. So in many ways, social media has, in its own way, saved us. It's also about advertising yourself. That's one thing we do on social media, which can be good or bad. It's about forming friendships, creating blogs, and guess what? Podcasts, which is what I'm doing. And that's all part of the world of social media as well. Now, you're all familiar with it, be it Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all those things, LinkedIn. It's called dialogic transmission. Now, what does that mean? Well, that means many sources and many receivers. So many people generate the stuff and many people receive it. The more traditional type of transmission is monologic, where there's one source and many receivers. So for example, the Irish Times would be kind of monologic, even though lots of people write for the Irish Times. It's one source and then many people look at that, whereas social media is a bit different. And again, you're getting the idea now, it's a massive amount of people interacting in all these different kinds of ways. How was it invented?
Well, there's a revolution going on in rec rooms, offices and classrooms around the world, night and day, through a computer network called Internet.
I mean, this is a fascination for me, because as I said, when I was younger, there was none of it. Well, it was there, actually, but it was very rare to see. I mean, the army had a kind of a social network type system. There was a thing called the ARPANET in 1967 in California.
Users sitting at a terminal would be able to hit a key and see a response virtually instantly, almost as if that computer, wherever it were, looked like it was in the same room.
And that was the first time ever one computer communicated with another. Now, what I mean by that is a human then did something on the computer and a signal was sent to another. And 1967 is the beginning of all of this. A thing called the Transmission Control Protocol, or TCP, was invented. And that TCP is a common term that we have now. Things called bulletin boards. Anybody old might remember them. They were set up as ways to communicate between people on computers. And data compression became a key technology, because a lot of data begins to get sent around beginning in the 70s and then the 80s. A thing called the JPEG, you're all familiar with that. That turned out to be a key invention to allow things to be sent between us. And basically, the computer scientists and the programmers and the software people really got behind this in a massive way to invent all the things we now take for granted. And guess what? Half the world's population is now on some kind of social media. Who would have thought? Massive uptake all over the world. And as I say, it is dominating our lives. Another very important thing that was invented was the World Wide Web. And that involves a thing called Hypertext Transfer Protocol, or HTTP. Again, you've all heard of that, and amazing. A guy called Tim Berners-Lee, a UK scientist working in CERN in Switzerland in 1990, he basically got fed up.
And so then when I get to CERN, it's just frustrating, all these systems that are incompatible. And if I'm sitting on one computer system, I can't get information on the other one. I have to log on.
He knew there was loads of information on different computers in CERN. Now remember, CERN is the massive sort of nuclear research place in Europe. And he wanted to link these computers together. And he wrote some software and he managed to link up a whole load of computers in one big web. And he coined the term web.
And so after, then when you realize, you know, it could be simpler. And the web is really basically a very, very simple idea, very simple.
And he invented the term web browser. You could now get information off any of those computers is what actually he was able to do. And then he coined the term the World Wide Web. He didn't really think it was going to go global. It's strange, even though he invented that term. And now we know WWW became the thing. Web pages, of course, that's what was going on there. You were looking at web pages on different computers, I guess, is what he invented. 1988. Is another key moment, actually just slightly before this, where the first internet connection was established. And that was a part of this, because obviously Berners-Lee knew about that as well. And Berners-Lee invented hypertext, another word you're all familiar with, established servers for the first time. And what he did was he mapped hypertext onto the internet, is the phrase for this. Invented the uniform resource locator, URL, and browsers. So Tim Berners-Lee, he really deserves credit for inventing the world that we now live in, because all these words we now know. And of course, very, very importantly, Google gets involved. Now, I'll never forget the first time I looked on Google and searched for something, and I realized all human knowledge was now accessible through my computer, because you could search on Google for things. Isn't it incredible? And that took off like a rocket. I've often wondered, what would the Irish monks who did the Book of Kells have made of Google? They would have thought, God, this is the work of the devil. But there you have it. All human knowledge is now in the palm of your hand on your smartphone. Again, absolutely incredible technology has been invented there. Now, let's look at the actual sort of aspects of this that are intriguing. What we've done effectively is we've ceded control of our lives to these machines.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave.
I'm afraid I can't do that.
Now, what do I mean by that? Well, they get access to us, don't they? They get access to all our interests and all the things we do. Every time you go online, every time you click into something, someone records that somewhere, or a machine does. And of course, that's a slight concern, because there's issues around privacy, there's issues around access to our private lives in various ways. So we have actually given up control into these machines. And remember, what would your life be like if you didn't have your iPhone? You would be devastated.
Do you ever feel dumb without your iPhone?
Researchers at the University of Missouri had iPhone users solve a series of puzzles. They noticed people performed better when they had their phones with them.
And when deprived, researchers say participants had elevated heart rate, blood pressure, anxiety, and performed much worse. The study's author says the findings suggest that, quote, iPhones are capable of becoming an extension of ourselves.
Totally. Massive anxiety hormones go up. Oh, I haven't got my iPhone on me. So we're app dependent on these things. And someone has mused, let's say we're dependent on these things. And someone has mused, let's say we went back to the Stone Age. Now, that's an interesting idea, I suppose. Let's say there's some awful thing happened, and I won't mention the pandemic. But let's say all technology disappeared for whatever reason. We could never reinvent it. It took so many steps, tiny, tiny steps, to go from, you know, the Stone Age or whatever it was, primitive technology, I suppose, up to a smart iPhone. It's incredible how much technology and how many tens of thousands of people are packed into that. So it's a wonderful thing in many ways, an example of technology being deployed. Now, when you begin to dig into it more and more, you realize it is more and more malign. Now, we know it's wonderful, and I'll come back to that at the end. But the fact is, there's a consensus emerging that this may be doing more harm than good. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, 40% of teenagers check their phones twice during the night, for crying out loud. Good science that has assessed that. That's really bad, because that means their sleep is disrupted. And that's a negative. It can give rise to anxiety, depression. Bad sleep is a huge negative for people. So twice a night, on average, people are waking up and checking their iPhones. Secondly, the light that comes off an iPhone, it's in this blue range, that will keep you awake. And if you're on your iPhone before you go to bed, or any computer screen, that blue light is disrupting your sleep anyway. So we're all wondering now, we're actually living in a world full of sleep destruction.
I am almost exhausted.
Maybe that's why everybody gets angry all the time, because we're all slightly sleep disrupted. And then, of course, you go on your phone and you attack someone else, you see, because you're angry probably. So it's a funny thing, this, the fact that it's keeping us awake in that way. That's a negative. Another one is being played by social media. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, you know the way advertisers can get at you through knowing about your interests. And there's lots of studies showing you reveal things about yourself and ads then might be sent to you. This is always the dream of advertising, to aim the ad at someone who wants to read it, kind of thing. That was always the goal of advertising anyway. And one fascinating study, they use Facebook to figure out who was introvert and who was extrovert based on the words they were using on Facebook. And no permission was given for this. Now, this was done without people's permission, which just shows you. And then they could classify people, and then they could fire ads at them. So, for example, a beauty product. If you're an introvert, the ad would go, "Beauty isn't about always being on show." That was the ad aimed at the introvert. At the extrovert, the ad was, "Love the spotlight, feel the moment." And guess what? That would encourage the extrovert to buy the beauty product, or the introvert, depending on what the ad was. They sent the ads out to 3.5 million users, and there were over 10,000 people engaged with those ads, and there were 390 purchases because of those ads being tailored at those specific people. It happened within a second they sent the ad out to all those people, by the way, and then the purchases came in. And they could correlate the phrasing in the ad to whether you're an extrovert or an introvert and your likelihood of buying something. Now, there you have it. Isn't that amazing? And that's going on all the time in the background, remember. And they're tailoring ads to your personality. And if they do that, they've shown overall there's a 1.59-fold increased likelihood that you might buy the thing if they fire it at you based on your personality. So be very careful. You're being played then, in a way, by these different approaches. The other concern we have is democracy. And of course, with all the elections, the Trump election before the one that just happened, Brexit, there's loads of evidence of data being used to fire campaign slogans at people. Most famously, Cambridge Analytica.
Beginning in 2014, many Facebook users were paid to take a personality test funded by Cambridge Analytica, agreeing to give up some personal data. But what they didn't know at the same time, the company was scooping up all of their friends' private information too. So a survey that started with about 270,000 people ultimately collected more than 50 million profiles.
The level of what can be predicted about you
based on what you like on Facebook is higher than that your wife would say about you, what your parents or friends can say about you.
They were paid $5 million by the Trump campaign to aim adverts at people who may be wavering as to whether they should vote for Trump or not. And they had a boast, Cambridge Analytica. They said they had 5,000 data points on 220 million Americans. They knew a lot about these Americans and they could tailor things at those Americans in terms of the vote. Facebook were eventually taken to court over this because they were involved in some of the data, or data was got off Facebook. And that happened especially with the Brexit campaign, because again, pro-Brexit messages were sent to people. Facebook paid a fine of $5 billion. And that was incredible because they were felt to be breaching privacy here. So it's a very complicated thing. And how do you take people like Facebook to court and so on? And we're in the middle of this in many ways. The control these things have over our lives is a key question. And whether they're controlling democracy. They certainly think it played a part in Brexit, this manipulation of people and sending adverts to people and so on. So that's an important part. Now, let's do a bit more on the negative. And then I'm going to end on the positive because I am positive, as people now know. Cyberbullying. Harassment, trolling, all these are new terms, are happening on social media. Dire effects on people's mental health. And then when you combine that with sleep disturbance, it's awful. And especially women, they get vicious attacks on social media. Really nasty stuff is fired at women. Women politicians, for example. Women epidemiologists, who I know, are absolutely in bits because their awful, vile stuff is thrown at them. You know, there's a great line in Trainspotting 2, where the key character says, spew bile at people you don't know on Twitter. You know, that seems to be part of modern life, isn't it? It's a terrible thing. And the question is, should Twitter and other people be limited now? And should they be limiting all this hate? And there is talk of doing that now. Keywords will ditch the tweet or whatever it happens to be. And I think it's very important. Not for someone like me, because I don't see it and I ignore it anyway. But if you're younger, this could be very damaging. And there is a thing called Facebook depression. It's a type of depression that Facebook drives in people. And it's tied into what's called FOMO, fear of missing out, you know, and really can make people's lives miserable. And the other part of this is, there's a thing called the hedonic treadmill. There's the scientific term. What's the hedonic treadmill? Well, every time you get a like, oh, you get a little buzz off it and you sense of hedonism and you get trapped into this treadmill of trying to get liked and trying to be popular on social media and all that. And as humans, of course, we're driven to this. We all want to be liked, especially if you're a teenager and you're in your 20s. You really want people to like you. And if there's hate coming at you and you're not getting sufficient likes, that could put you into a depression. So it's a very serious thing and something has to be done. And lots of people are discussing ways to control this. And one really good thing that happened actually was Black Mirror. One of my favourite science fiction shows. There was a famous one called Nosedive, set in the future, where everything was rated and you got scores, basically. Your socioeconomic status changed based on the number of likes you were getting, kind of thing, you know. And this is a very depressing one, actually, because the woman who's the victim of all this really has a terrible time, has a big breakdown, because, of course, she's obsessed with getting more and more likes and then her socioeconomic status improved. Now, very interestingly, Adam Morelli, who's the head of Instagram, he spotted this and he stopped doing outward facing likes on Instagram because he saw this could be damaging to people. And that was a great response to this. So there are ways to deal with this, I suppose. But remember, let's not be too negative. We can control these things. You can control yourself by turning off. I know it's hard to do. I will turn off social media occasionally and get a break from it. That's good. But remember, it's a fantastic resource. It's like most things in life, isn't it? There's good bits and bad bits. And social media is the same. And I'm going to finish now on a few interesting facts. As you know, us scientists, we love facts, especially when they're interesting. And there's numbers behind them even better. So first of all, 30% of Americans get their news on Facebook. Their only source of news is Facebook. And of course, we know young people don't watch TV anymore. All their news comes in through social media channels. And that's a very important fact because, again, this can't be a free for all. Because the news might be, you know, suboptimal, shall we say, for those people looking at it. Secondly, you know the bird on Twitter? You all know Twitter, don't you? Guess what that bird is called? The bird's called Larry. Why was he called that? Well, he's named after Larry Bird, who was in the Boston Celtics. Obviously, whoever came up with that name was a fan of the Boston Celtics. So there you have it. The bird name is Larry. And then the other very interesting fact, I think, is on LinkedIn, there are millions and millions of people on LinkedIn. They scanned LinkedIn for the commonest word used on LinkedIn. And guess what it was? It was a phrase, highly motivated. So everybody is highly motivated and that's on your LinkedIn profile. That can't be right, can it? But there we have it. Highly motivated is the key thing. So there's my view at the moment of social media. A very interesting aspect, very important for science, very important for information dissemination, very important for our social lives as well. Just be careful when you use it. Ignore all the hate, burn it, you know, forget all that. Use it to your advantage. Don't be played by it. It's a wonderful, wonderful resource. And we're all in WhatsApp groups with our families. Isn't it brilliant sharing things? So overall, it should be good for us. And let's hope the owners of all these social media outlets control it into the future, because that's a really important aspect of this. There you have it, the science of social media. Thanks very much for listening. So please tune in to the podcast. Please give us a rating, by the way. We're very keen on ratings, you see, because that means we get more visibility. It'd be brilliant to do that for us. I'd like to ask you to do that. And then, of course, keep subscribing and tune in every week. And don't forget, I'm on every week with Pat Kenny on News Talk. Thanks very much for listening.